5. Where fortune decrees escape from this miserable burden. There had been a time when Lijun and her family were happy. Not spectacularly happy, not extraordinary and exhausting with delight, just happy enough. Her dad had worked at a law firm. He ran the professional library and information services. Her mother was a history lecturer at the university until she got sick. They lived in a small apartment on the 6th floor of a block near Wong Nai Chung Sports Center, overlooking a cracked and overgrown parking lot that a contractor had once meant to turn into a residential building, but for some reason the permissions had never come through. On the balcony of the apartment, Lai Chun's mother had grown tomato plants from seed, and flowers and herbs to make tea. Lai Chun had sat with her plump little legs pushed through the bars of the balcony, staring at the disused parking lot and the life growing there, the plants breaking through the asphalt, the small trees craning toward the sun. Her mother became sick when Lai Chun was 10 years old. At first, it seemed as if it would be okay. The doctors said that this kind of cancer was operable, that she might be sick for a year with chemo and recovery, but after that, oh, she was young and strong. There was a great chance that all would be well. How great a chance? Oh, 95, even 99%. Lai Chun imagined 100 girls like her standing in the wood-floored sports hall at the Wong Nai Chung Center. 100 girls whose mothers had been given a 99% chance of recovery. Each of them called one by one from the hall to receive the good news. Until just 10 were standing there. Just 5. Just 2. And Chun and the other girl couldn't look at each other. Until the final name was called, and it wasn't her. Until she was left standing alone in the sports hall. That's what a 99% chance means. It means one girl left standing alone through her 11th birthday and her 12th and her 13th, waiting for her mother to get well, knowing, eventually, that she would never get well. Every time they fought the cancer back, it returned more strongly somewhere else, like an enemy army hiding, regrouping, striking from a new direction. When had her mother decided to go to war? What had she done to provoke this assault? It was an illness that ate up Chun's childhood and turned the family inward to the exhausting boredom of tablets and vomiting and trying to coax a little soup down and skin like paper and a fall in the bathroom and listening through the wall to her mother moaning in pain at night. It was no wonder that Lai Jun's father missed the deadlines for the forms to apply for the British National Overseas Passport. The time that they should have been applying was, it turned out, her mother's final illness. By the time the funeral was over, there was a different and more complex process, a longer wait. The political realities had changed. By the time Chun and her father surfaced from the long underwater swim of cancer, there had been years of dissidents working in Hong Kong against the Chinese government, publishing underground newspapers and hacking government websites and organizing protests and, 3 times, small bombs on the street in the early mornings, destroying shop fronts but not property, demanding the democracy that had been promised. Promises never last forever, especially promises made by governments. While her father struggled with the new and more difficult passport process, Lai Chun had taken refuge in her studies. Her grades had dipped during her mother's illness, and it offended her. She was a top-grade student, with her parents' ability to read enormous amounts of material, to focus and to retain what she read. She signed up for the extra credit courses in Latin and ancient Greek. She enjoyed her mastery of their complicated puzzle box sentences. She found something tremendously satisfying, though she could not have said what it was then, in knowing that these entire cultures were dead and gone, but that careful, patient work could retrieve something from the wreckage, could make them live again. Her father met her after school most days, walked her home, the two of them trying together to fill the space where her mother had been. He He was a gentle, thoughtful person, and she pretended to enjoy his meticulous work stories about precise filing systems. One sweltering day in mid-August, they stopped for Chun to buy green tea egg waffles from a street vendor with one gold front tooth. There had been a riot at the weekend, but that was past now. The only sign was paper strewn about the street and a jittery air among the people. Chun found out later precisely what it was about that riot, that particular weekend's firecracker bang, this exact day that had, invisibly, pushed the PRC too far. She offered her father an egg waffle. He wrinkled his nose. They turned onto Singwu Road. And suddenly there was a sound so loud and intense that it penetrated her body like a physical force pushing her down to the ground. She couldn't breathe. The air was on fire. Things were upside down, her head pressed into the asphalt. She struggled sideways. She couldn't hear anything. When she looked at the sky, she saw white papers fall upward in the air, half charred. There were no sirens and no screaming. Someone was sobbing a distance away from her. There were three loud explosions. Jeanne pushed herself upright. She still couldn't hear properly. Her father was next to her, coughing. A long scrape on his head, but otherwise okay. She looked around. All along the road were people fallen, coughing, covered in white heavy dust. Around them, showers of papers were falling to earth. Later, she and her father would say to each other, "You see, we were lucky after all." If they'd been 10 minutes earlier, if they hadn't stopped for egg waffles, they would have been in their apartment block when it exploded. Officially, after a long investigation, the PRC-approved Hong Kong government concluded that the apartment building had been destroyed by a gas leak which caused an explosion. The utility company was fined and censured. Several people were fired. Unofficially, it was reported on the internet and by foreign media that an apartment in the block had been used as a nerve center by protesters for nearly 2 years, that it would be trivially easy to make a small drone attack on a gas line look like a gas explosion. Officially, PRC troops hadn't entered the city until the government of Hong Kong admitted that it had lost control and called for their help because of the escalating violence. Unofficially, it was well understood that the PRC had lost patience. If you needed a breakdown in law and order to justify sending troops in, well then, it was possible to provoke such a breakdown. We all live in history. Lai Chun and her father were part of a history they could not fully perceive at the time, let alone control. All their possessions were gone, of course. All their papers, their passports, their documents. They had a perfect right to the British National Overseas Passports, but it took more than 3 years for everything to be untangled. 3 years, first in a shelter in Hong Kong, and then in a British offshore refugee center, waiting for appointments and information. Lai Chun continued her studies in the refugee center, a charity, and two teachers from the British-style school in Hong Kong who had seen her exceptional promise sent her the books and thumb drives with video lectures on them. It took enough energy to blot out almost everything else, and she knew that if she didn't continue studying, her father would die. Not metaphorically. By this point, he was only held together by hope and belief in her. They were held together by needing each other. She read the Iliad, about a battle no one had chosen and no one wanted, and the Odyssey, about the longest journey home and the great burden of misery in just keeping going. In Homer's Iliad, she found at last some words that comforted her. It was a passage after all the exciting battles that had seen such loss. After the great hero of Troy, Hector, had slain Patroclus of the Greeks, after Achilles, Patroclus's lover, had torn through the Trojans to reach Hector, had slaughtered him. After Achilles had dragged Hector's body behind his chariot around and around the walls of Troy. After all these things, in the still of the night, Hector's father, Priam, came to the Greek camp in the dead of night, walked through the tents of his enemies, and finding Achilles, knelt before the man who had slain his son, and kissed the hand that had killed him, and begged Achilles for Hector's body. At this point, what could one expect? Magnanimity from Achilles, perhaps? Murderous rage would be in character. Instead, Achilles told Priam to get up, to sit near him, to take wine and food. Achilles said, "At the doors of the gods there are two urns. One is filled with evil fortune, and one is filled with good fortune. Zeus digs his hands into the urns and scatters fortune on us. On some people, good and evil fortunes fall, and on some, only evil fortunes." This passage was the only thing that gave Jun relief. She thought of it often, until she could almost see the fortunes raining down on her. It hadn't all been bad fortune for her. 38 people had died in the building, and she and her father had both survived. The winds would change, because winds always change, and blow some new fortune her way. Much later in her life, Lai Chun had made a video called How to Survive the Psychological Effects of an Apocalyptic Event, and 1.6 million people had watched it. It wasn't one of her most popular ones. She said, "You'll need to keep busy." She said, "Focus on your own survival. Look forward, not back." She said, "Even if you don't feel okay, you will be okay one day." She said, "For a long time, it will feel unreal. You will be unable to accept your situation." She said, "Don't blame yourself. Fortune tumbles down onto us like scraps of paper in the wind. Joyful fortune and miserable fortune. You can as little choose your own luck as choose which raindrop falls on your head." All of this was true, and yet it was not enough. Another thing you could do was to figure out why exactly the building you lived in had been targeted by the PRC, and follow carefully the evidence that the dissidents' communications hadn't been as secure as they'd thought. In exchange for access to the valuable Chinese markets, Medlar had agreed to allow the PRC to monitor certain location data on the new Medlar Torx. Working on their mission to bring people together, Fantail had allowed certain governments, including China, to read certain Fantail PAL artificial intelligence requests deemed to relate to terrorist organizations. Zimri Nomik hadn't even had to be asked. Anvil wanted stability and prosperity, and neither of those were achieved by splinter groups blowing up storefronts. Obviously, Anvil Chat would comply with all local laws. So, here she was, on an island with them, at the end of the world. Lai Chun tipped her face to the sky and wondered what kind of weird-ass mixed fortune had fallen square in the center of her head.